It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, animals are helping out with physical therapy. We talk about a new grad school program here in Wisconsin that trains therapists to get a boost from a four-legged helper. First, instances of abuse within the Catholic Church have been widely publicized in the past 20 years. The U.S. Department of Justice and multiple states are now investigating the sexual abuse of children by clergy. Ireland, Germany, and other countries around the world are reporting widespread patterns of abuse as well. Pope Francis has condemned the abuse. Earlier this year, he convened a conference of bishops to discuss the protection of minors in the church. Our next guest thinks a more fundamental change is needed. He says in order to root out abuse and ensure that the church stays relevant to its members, traditional Catholic power structures need to be dismantled. James Carroll is a National Book Award-winning author, historian, and journalist. He's also a former Catholic priest himself. His recent cover story for The Atlantic is titled Abolish the Priesthood. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure to be with you.
We've talked about the abuse scandals here in Wisconsin and around the world a lot, and you paint a straight line from the institution of the priesthood, from clericalism, as you describe it, to that abuse. Can you connect those two for us?
Well, it's a I'm grief-struck to discuss this and to be writing about it the way I am. But yes, in a nutshell, the church's maleness and its misogyny are inseparable from the church's structure, and they are both at the root of this current dysfunction, the abuse of minors by priests, and more momentously, the way in which the vast majority of bishops, almost all bishops, support the predators instead of the victims. So the church's maleness and the church's essential denigration of women are key problems, and they are both tied intimately into the structure of the priesthood, and that's what I'm calling into question.
A key part of your piece, I think, is the idea that the Catholic Church is worth saving. It does a lot of good in the world. It isn't enough just to leave and do something else. Can you make the case for the good in the church that, in your eyes, make it worth trying to tackle this problem?
Well, you know, people have been leaving the Catholic Church in droves, even here in the United States, which has been a very strong Catholic tradition. My strong argument is that we Catholics who are alienated from the church structure over this crisis should not leave but stay with it, because the church is a crucial institution. It's, of course, for those of us who are believers, a transcendent presence of the Holy One, of God, in the world. But more than that, the church is the most far-reaching global non-governmental organization on the planet. It crosses boundaries of rich and poor, highly intellectual and illiterate, north and south, technologically savvy, technologically ignorant. It's the only institution that crosses such borders on such a scale, and it does tremendous good around the world. There are more than 1 billion Catholics. Legions and legions of them run about 150,000 schools and universities, about 50,000 health centers and hospitals. These are Catholics doing the work of the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, as we say. They are the heartbeat of the church. Most of them, of course, are not clergy, although many are religious sisters. And my strong, strong conviction, what I want to shout from the rooftops, is this institution is urgently needed for the future of the human species. We must see to its reform so that it is fully rational, free of superstition, not fundamentalist, committed to justice, social justice, as is the tradition, and above all, becomes a tribune of the equality of women, which, as you know, is an urgently important signal around the planet of the healthy future of the human people.
What would the Catholic Church look like in your positive view without the hierarchy as it stands now, without the current institution of the priesthood?
Well, it's important to step back a little bit and see history. The church has taken its culture and structure from surrounding norms and traditions since the beginning. So in the beginning, the church formed itself in many ways in imitation of the Roman Empire. The diocese, for example, began as a Roman local government institution. The basilica began as the palace of the emperor. The trappings of the Roman Empire shaped the early church in powerful ways. And then in the Middle Ages, the trappings of feudal monarchy shaped the church in many ways. The pope became a kind of feudal monarch. The bishops became imitations of the secular ranking of lords and barons and princes and so forth. We even have that phrase, prince of the church. The culture of the Vatican reeks of the Middle Ages that established it, really. So what I'm arguing for is in the tradition, the church should move, as it's begun to, more fully into a culture of liberal democracy, a church that is fully transparent, engages with lay people as full equal members of the church, certainly women as full equal members of the power structure of the church. The church doesn't need to look like a medieval monarchy. That's not the will of God. That's an accident of history. So this movement toward a more democratic structure can sound in a way heretical, but in fact it began early in my lifetime during the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s, which was the beginning of a movement of the church toward structures of democracy. It was short-circuited and didn't fulfill itself, but that's where we have to head in the future.
Talking to James Carroll about his cover story in the Atlantic titled Abolish the Priesthood. He's calling for fundamental changes within the Catholic Church. Could some of the same goals be accomplished with a more modest reform, more transparency, more authority to punish wrongdoers, the predators you were talking about? Could you get rid of the bad stuff without such a radical change?
Yes, that's a great question. I think, alas, I've come to this more radical position. I'm essentially a conservative person temperamentally, but I've come to this because of the failure of the church over these 20 years of this festering scandal to deal with it in any real way. The kinds of reforms that you refer to could be readily implemented, and they haven't been, not even by Pope Francis, who otherwise is such a magnificent and revolutionary figure. The starting points are obvious. Ordain married men and ordain women. Bring women fully into the structure of the church's ministry and governance. The fact that the church doesn't do that is a moral offense at this point in history. The Catholic Church is standing against the equality of women at a time when institutions around the world, having learned from the great gift of the feminist revolution, have been themselves bringing women fully into positions of power. The Catholic Church can't be the only institution to stand against equality for women. So it's because of the failure of the church over the last 20 years to properly respond to the scandal of predator priests and complicit bishops, and now especially with the wonderful papacy of Pope Francis, but who has really profoundly disappointed the hopes that many of us put in him, because he hasn't put in place an authentic and responsible new alternative structure of handling the sex abuse crisis, nor has he been willing to dismantle the structures of clericalism. Interestingly, Pope Francis is eloquent in denouncing clericalism, but he never says what he means by that. Clericalism is the church's maleness and misogyny built into the structure of the priesthood, and he does not uproot it. And that's been the great recognition for me and I think many others. I'm treating this moment in the church's history as an emergency, and I'm really just saying it's not time for business as usual. We have to stop thinking in sort of the usual terms about how the church operates.
I think a concern among many Catholics is that if you were to adopt a model based on more on liberal democracy, might be a church then that moves with the tides in public opinion when at least some people would view the church as something that's supposed to be a steward of certain values that shouldn't change with public opinion.
Well, of course it should. It should. Liberal democracy I'm talking about is not majority rule. It's not taking cues from so-called public opinion. But there is an old Catholic tradition, the vox populi, the voice of the people. We believe in our traditional language that the Holy Spirit lives in the church and that the experience of the Catholic people is trustworthy, that we can learn from it. That's not the same thing as taking opinion polls, but it is a matter of paying attention to the experience of the people, the Catholic people. The Second Vatican Council defined the church not as the hierarchy, which is the way we usually think of it, but as the people of God. And liberal democracy is, I don't mean to make a fetish of that. And I'm not talking necessarily a republic governance. The university is an example of a liberal democracy, and yet it has a very clear and strong structure of authority. So please don't misunderstand me. I'm perhaps not speaking quite clearly enough. Liberal democratic values is what I'm looking for, what I'm advocating. And that means accountability. It means the power structure is accountable to the people. That's not the case now. It means transparency. That's not the case now. The secrecy of the cult of the priesthood is one of our biggest problems. And it means accountability for sin and for crime, a readiness to hand over the adjudication of crime to civil authorities, which the church is still resisting, even in this grievous matter of the abuse of minors by priests. So the values of liberal democracy can enshrine the essential values of the gospel. That's what I'm arguing for.
We're talking to author and former Catholic priest James Carroll about his recent cover story for The Atlantic. It's headlined, Abolish the Priesthood. James, as you mentioned, you're disappointed in the actions that Pope Francis has taken on these fronts. You say a lot of people within the hierarchy aren't going to want to end the hierarchy as it stands. You have kind of a prescription, an internal exile for Catholics. What would you want to see happen to make these changes?
Well, I'm not advocating the founding of a new church. Let's be clear about that. I've been a mass-going Catholic my entire life. And when the Pope was in Ireland last summer, his sadly inadequate response to the crisis in Ireland, which has been ground zero of the moral failures of the Catholic Church, that's what actually drove me to this new place I'm in. And I found it impossible to continue to go to Mass, which was a shocking thing to find. And I began what I discovered as time went on over the weeks and months. I began a kind of informal personal version of what we used to call in the Catholic tradition fasting and abstinence. I'm in a position of fasting and abstaining from the Eucharist itself, from going to Mass. I've understood myself as not in exile from the church because I refuse to leave it, but I am in what I'm calling internal exile. My assumption is that the structure of the hierarchy, the bishops and priests, are in a state of moral collapse now and soon to be a state of utter collapse as fewer and fewer people are priests. More and more Catholics leave the church. More and more people stop believing in the authority of the church. And so what I'm really advocating is that we stay with the church, even if we stay away from connecting with the organized, ordained structure of the church. That's what I'm doing. I'm not clear on what such a stance leads to. I'm certain that the Catholic Church will go on. I think it is important to stay with it so that the worst impulses of the church can be challenged and the best impulses can be supported. And I think we can patiently discover other ways of affirming our Catholic identity. There are many groups around now, women who have stopped going to ordained masses, who have formed groups of their own. In many places, the priest shortage has led to more and more lay people taking responsibility for various aspects of the church's life. We're in a period of evolution right now. We can't really say for sure what it leads to, but to do two things at once, detach from the corrupt, ordered, hierarchical structure of the church with its, for example, misogyny, its rejection of equality for women, say no to that, even while kind of standing loose with the forms that our religious practice takes, affirming our Catholic faith, maintaining our commitment to the corporal works of mercy, the heart of the gospel, maintaining especially our allegiance to Jesus Christ, and understanding that the church is nothing if not a community of people who lift up his memory. That's the first meaning of the church. And then trusting in the Spirit to see where this goes. Again, this is no time for business as usual. The bishops, and I'm sorry to say Pope Francis, are inviting a kind of business as usual approach, as we saw with the recent Vatican promulgation of the ways in which the abuse scandal is to be handled going forward, which was another version of business as usual, saying no to that, and then trusting this position of not being entirely in the fold.
Talking to James Carroll about the future of the Catholic Church, I want to bring on a caller now. Paul is with us in Prairie du Chien. Paul, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say I'm in agreement with your guest. I have two siblings that teach at different Catholic institutions, and you know, under Wisconsin law, if they know something's going on that's immoral, whatever, they are supposed to inform the police. But each year before school starts, they have a diocesan meeting with the bishop and the attorney for that diocese, and they're told, you go to your pastor and only your pastor. If you go to the police, you'll be fired. And yet, under the law, they are supposed to go to the police.
Paul, thanks for the call. Of course, we can't confirm that that's actually happening there. But, James, you've seen similar things in other institutions, other Catholic institutions.
Well, not just that. The Vatican promulgation of 2 or 3 weeks ago, a document called in Latin Vox Estis Lux Mundi, which is now the official policy of the Catholic Church on how to handle accusations of abusive clergy abusing minors. And one of the disappointments in that document, it moved the needle forward somewhat, but not nearly enough. And one of the main disappointments is that it does not require bishops to report to civil authorities credible accusations of minors being abused by priests. It requires those reports to be forwarded to other church officials. It's an example of what Paul just lifted up from the experience of his siblings. The church is still not requiring the reporting to civil authorities of credible accusations of minors being abused. This document does encourage church personnel to obey the law where they are. And so if the law requires it, then that should be obeyed. But the church policy itself does not make any such requirement, which is a significant signal of the way in which clericalism still has the bishops of the church in its grip.
in our last few moments. James, do you have hopes that the church can change as you see it for the better?
Well, of course I do. I wouldn't be continuing as a Catholic if I didn't. And the single largest example of that is my own experience as a young man watching the church make a huge leap forward with the Second Vatican Council under the leadership of the great Pope John the 23rd. Pope John changed the church in a few short years more than it had been changed in centuries. For the better, the most significant example of that was the way in which, with Pope John leading the way, the church renounced the pillar of anti-Semitism, which was the Christ killer charge lodged against the Jewish people. The Second Vatican Council said no to that, despite almost 2,000 years of tradition to the contrary. So I have seen a tremendous movement forward in my own lifetime, and I believe in the holiness of the church. I believe the Spirit is alive in the church, and I believe in the goodness of the Catholic people.
We'll leave it there. James, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, it's been my privilege. Thank you.
That's James Carroll, author, historian, and journalist. He was with us to talk about his recent cover story for The Atlantic that calls for abolishing the priesthood as it currently exists to save the Catholic Church. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of us count on pets to help us feel happy, maybe even for emotional support, and they can help us feel physically healthier, if nothing else, by motivating us to get out and walk with them. But a new program in Wisconsin takes it a step further by training practitioners to use animals for science-based therapy. Our next guest is the leader of a new animal-assisted therapy program at Concordia University, Wisconsin. It's the first of its kind in the state. Lois Harrison is Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at Concordia. She's also the School of Health Interprofessional Clinic Coordinator there in Mequon. Lois, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, people might think animals and therapy and think about the emotional support animals that are out there. You're taking this to another level with some science-based therapy, right?
Yes. Actually, animal-assisted therapy is utilizing animals to meet the goals that have already been established for therapy. So for physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech-language pathology, counseling. So it's really just another tool that we have to help meet the patient goals using the animal to facilitate.
So what are the students who will be taking this class? What kind of careers are they going into?
So the animal-assisted therapy certificate program at Concordia is an optional program, and it's open to any of the students entering physical therapy, occupational therapy, or speech-language pathology programs at Concordia.
And what led you at Concordia to set up this new certificate program for animal-assisted therapy?
Well, we've had Lutheran Church Charities canine comfort dog named Zoe at Concordia since 2014, and her role as a comfort dog on campus, we just saw the positive impact that she had, and we already had our established therapy programs there and thought that that would be a good mix of the use of the dogs in their comfort role to utilize them to train practitioners to utilize animals in therapy. So we were able to do fundraising, and we purchased a second dog named Sage, who we got on campus last August.
If, say, I'm a physical therapy student in this program, what kind of things am I going to learn by working with Sage and Zoe?
So the certificate program, so any certificate program is a more in-depth study in a content area. So they are going to learn not only how to do animal-assisted therapy, but to do it utilizing the evidence and what the science says and what our experience says in order to maintain safety both for the dog, keeping the welfare of the dog at the utmost importance, just as it would be keeping safety for the individual. So it's really teaching them best practice in animal-assisted therapy. So they take a series of 7 courses over the course of 2 years, and they're doing that in addition to pretty rigorous curricular programs in their major.
Talking to Lois Harrison from Concordia University, Wisconsin, about the state's first animal-assisted therapy program. It's there at Concordia. Lois, what do we know? What does the science tell us about some of the benefits of bringing, say, a dog into a therapy setting in addition to the other physical or occupational therapy somebody might be receiving?
So really, any interactions between humans and animals are based on the strength of the human-animal bond. And that bond is a mutually beneficial relationship that humans and animals have. And it's really influenced by behaviors of both that positively influence health and well-being of both. So building upon that, already the benefits that we see from human-animal interactions, we build upon that to utilize them in therapy. So animals in general are a social lubricant. They facilitate interactions. They have physiologic impact. They decrease heart rate, decrease blood pressure. They can decrease pain perception. They have emotional psychological benefits, decreasing stress, anxiety. So when you look at it from a therapeutic perspective, all of those benefits can further facilitate than what we as therapists are trying to do as we interact with our patients and clients to meet their goals for therapy.
I think one example I read about was, you know, if somebody, say, is getting physical therapy or occupational therapy working with their hands, that might involve petting or grooming a dog, which I imagine might help people engage a lot better than just some sort of abstract random exercise.
Right. So think about being engaged in the therapy process. And therapy isn't always fun. It's hard work. And really the benefits of therapy, no matter what profession they are, will be enhanced as the patient is more engaged and participating in therapy. So if we were only using animals just for the motivational factor and that increases participation, that's probably going to increase the likelihood that that patient will meet their goals.
And are some patients going to be more willing maybe to work on their therapy with a dog in the room as opposed to just dealing with their human therapist?
Sure. We've definitely seen that. Before we got Sage, we utilized Zoe, the other Lutheran Church Charities comfort dog that we have on campus. We actually utilized her in some pro bono clinics that we had on campus, and we were able to see her very positive impact even in one session of utilizing her. So she was used as a motivation for a child to participate in therapy. So if the child knew that if she participated for a certain period of time, she'd be able to pet Zoe afterwards. So obviously, if she's going to participate more, the patient is more likely to reach the goals that have been established.
Now, the program here is all about training the humans, but do the dogs get any kind of special training coming into this?
Yeah, our program is unique because we're utilizing a Lutheran Church Charities comfort dog, canine comfort dog, and those dogs are trained by an organization called Lutheran Church Charities. That's one of the main things that they do. And these dogs are trained for over 2,000 hours. So they're trained at the level of a service dog. They do not have that designation, but they have a very high level of training. They know more than 40 commands. They're trained to work with a number of different handlers who are then trained to work with them. They are trained to work in a variety of situations, so they're very adaptable to different settings, and that it just makes them ideal to be utilized in animal-assisted therapy.
Now, the first cohort of students started this program last fall, still a new program. What have you been hearing from the students so far?
The students love it. Again, these are students that are taking on additional work in their already very difficult, rigorous, high credit load curriculum, but they're obviously enjoying working with the dog. They're enjoying learning new skills that they can use that they would not have learned otherwise. Anecdotally, students have said it's fun information, so they still need to study, they still need to read, but it's something different than what they're doing, and so they're really enjoying their time doing it.
So I imagine they're pretty motivated to begin with, but just like the patients, it sounds like the dogs might motivate them even a little more.
Sure. They're definitely wanting to work with the dog. You know, more than myself, probably, as director of the program, but I'm a necessary component of it. But they really do enjoy. Two of the students who are in the program had already been trained as handlers for Zoe, the first comfort dog that we had on campus. So they already had an understanding of really what these dogs can do and the impact that they can have. And I think they're excited to be able to apply it in their future practice as clinicians.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to wrap up with. Ultimately, is the hope that then the graduates of the certificate program go out into a clinic or an institutional setting or wherever they work, and that they can integrate what they've learned and hopefully have access to a trained dog and use that in the therapy they provide.
Right, that's exactly it. So they would obviously need to have a dog that was appropriate for it, but they now have the skills to really provide animal-assisted therapy, utilizing best practice, keeping humans and animals safe, doing effective therapy based on their participation in the certificate program.
And I imagine Zoe and Sage are both fun to work with.
They are.
Lois, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Lois Harrison, Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. We talked to her about a new animal-assisted therapy certification program she runs at the school. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When your property tax bill arrives in December, it shows the total amount you owe, as well as a breakdown of the taxing authorities that make up that cost: the state, county, municipality, and local school and technical college districts. State Democrats want to add another item to that list: voucher schools. These are private, mostly religious schools that accept students on taxpayer-funded vouchers. About 40,000 low- and middle-income students attend voucher schools in Wisconsin. The program costs state and local taxpayers more than $300 million a year. Chris Larson is a Democratic state senator from Milwaukee and the ranking Democrat on the Senate Education Committee. He's one of the sponsors of the voucher school property tax bill. Senator Larson, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Well, give us the basics. How, if passed, would this work?
Well, as soon as if we pass this bill, it would just mean that there's another item added on to every person's tax bill. So they would have an understanding of not just their local school district and how much money is coming off their property tax bill for that, but how much money is also being shifted over to voucher schools, whether that be the statewide voucher program, that be the Milwaukee voucher program, the Racine voucher program, or the special needs voucher program. So there's four. And so people would end up having about probably at least two of these on their tax bills. You give them an idea of actually how much they're spending on this second, or in some cases third, school district that's operating right now largely in the background, without people knowing where the money's coming from.
And why did you see a need to do this?
It's about transparency. I think the vouchers in our state, as long as they've been around for 30 years, there's never been a chance to really publicly debate them on their merits for an up or down vote before they've been expanded. So every time they've come to fruition, it's right before a big budget vote. They're thrown in there without the public knowing. We are just asking for the basic level of transparency, which is how much money is actually going out of school districts and going to fund the second school district. So it's about transparency. I think the more that people know, the more people will recognize that there's a whole other system operating that a lot of people actually don't realize is there.
Now, the School Choice of Wisconsin president Jim Fender told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that the school funding formulas are too complicated to come down to a single number on our property tax bill. How do you see us arriving at that number?
The bill is pretty simple. It says this would include information by school district where the property is located, and it would talk about what the aid reduction has been for that school district as a result of money going to vouchers. So it's pretty simple to do. I think the real problem is they've been operating in the background for so long, they don't want people to recognize that money is going to a second school system, which largely has not lived up to the promises that were laid out over the 30 years of its existence.
Is this about transparency, or is this just kind of a symbolic dig at the school choice system in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's both. You could say it's both, for sure. I will say that there's for the longest time, people have said that it was going to promise a lot for our students. They've said that it was going to be less than 5% of any school. They've said that this is going to be open just for those in high poverty. And they said that the competition would lift all schools, that everyone would do better. But over the years, that's ended up shifting. So we actually have over 80% of the schools get 100% of their funding from vouchers. And at the same time, they don't have to have the same level of accountability. They don't have to have the same expertise in teachers. Heck, they don't even have to have a standard for what a graduation means, what it means to graduate from some of these schools. So this should be, you could view it both ways. It should be the minimum ante, the minimum table stakes to having a school district that operates, and many of them operate 100% from taxpayer funds, saying how much of the money is actually coming from our public schools. Because right now, in a lot of the cases, when you get your bill, you just see one number for public schools, and people think, well, gosh, they're not doing a good job with all that money. But in reality, a good chunk of it is actually going to this other set of schools that people don't actually know about. I think it's a start.
Governor Evers had included a similar provision in his budget to what you're calling for. It was taken out by the Joint Finance Committee. Are you proposing roughly the same thing?
Yeah, we wanted to kind of wait to see how that was going to play out. We proposed this last session, too, so I'm really glad that Governor Evers, and he supported it then as superintendent, about making sure there was transparency, because he's responsible for cutting the check that goes out without much choice in it when he was superintendent. So I think he understands the need for making sure that all tax dollars are being spent in a transparent way. So now that we know that that's been pulled out, we reintroduced it as a separate standalone bill to keep the conversation going.
We're talking to State Senator Chris Larson about school funding in the state. He is a co-sponsor of a provision that would require property tax bills to include information about how much of the money is going to the state's voucher program, whether the Milwaukee, the Racine, or the statewide program, or a special needs program. I want to turn more generally to the state school budget, Senator. The Joint Finance Committee approved a $500 million funding increase for schools. Governor Evers wanted $1.4 billion in general funding. Big difference, too, within those numbers when it comes to special education. What do you see happening now in budget negotiations?
Well, I mean, let's back up for a second. I think if there's any point in this budget where the Joint Finance Committee should give some deference to Governor Evers, it should be in education. This is a guy who not only spent his life in public instruction, right, as a teacher, as a principal, as a superintendent, and just about every job in between. He wrote this budget before the election. And there were some folks, myself included, saying, look, we need to make up for even larger gap. But he stood firm and said, look, this is what I proposed going into the election. People knew him for education. He put forward the exact same budget that he had introduced before the election. People voted for him. He won. And I think it's on the Joint Finance Committee to say, look, this is one of those areas that we should just let it be. People really want to make up for the largest cut in education in state history, which we saw over the last 8 years. They want to make sure that we're restoring the pledge of 60% funding for special education, making sure that no school district in the state is held harmless, and every other issue that he put forward. So I think anything less than that is we're falling short of the promise that Tony Evers came in with. We're falling short of what the public really wants, and not just Democratic or Republican, but all across the state. Every school district is suffering, and not only do they need to make up for that gap of the last 10 years, but we need to get ahead of it so that we have that point of pride that makes Wisconsin, Wisconsin, in a strong public education.
That said, Republicans are saying, hey, $1.4 billion, it's a big number, too big to manage in the state budget.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Governor Evers paid for it, right? You did it through the Badger Care expansion, taking the Medicaid funds that have been turned back for whatever reason. 37 other states have done it. Heck, Mike Pence has even taken the expansion when he was governor. So there's funds from that. There's funds where he caps the agriculture manufacturing tax credit, or so-called AgMan tax credit, and he uses those funds to invest directly in our future by investing in students. So he ended up funding it. I'm not sure where the Joint Finance Committee is going to scrape together funds for other priorities, but The fact is, by the state not putting those funds forward, what they've been forcing local school districts to do is absorb those cuts in themselves by, you know, slashing staff salaries, increasing class sizes, and cutting down on available programming. So either we're funding it at the state or we're going to fund it by cutting into the future. And I think most people would rather fund it now and have a brighter future and a educated population.
As I mentioned, one of the biggest differences in funding in the schools is when it comes to special education costs. What do you see schools dealing with right now with our current level of special education funding?
I mean, it's plummeted, right? You can talk to any teacher, any principal in the state. And we used to have the pledge that we were going to pick up 60% from the state. We did it in the 80s. Actually, in the 70s, we were actually higher than that. But it's plummeted since then to well under 30%. And because there is something in state law called continuous effort, anytime there is special ed students, you have to continue the same effort. You have to put the same funds in. And because there's not funds coming from the state, it comes out of their general operating revenue, and they have to pick it up by increasing property taxes or cutting from some other place. So the state had made that pledge. We want to make sure that we are giving everybody an opportunity at success. And by the state mandating that they have to do this continuous effort and that we're not going to give them additional funds, they're going to be squeezed. So I think Tony Evers knows this better than anybody, having spent his life in education, having been the superintendent, and said, look, this helps make sure that those students are funded, that those students are cared for, they're getting the attention that they need, and that funds that have been pulled from other areas can go back to making sure that those areas are not being cut back on. So it's a big one. And this is, again, this is the table stakes of making sure that we're abiding by our pledge, both the 60% for special ed and the two-thirds funding pledge that we've had, they used to have even back in the Thompson administration, right, of making sure the state is actually funding our kids.
In our last 30 seconds or so, education is just one part of the state budget, a big part, but just one. As you look ahead through the summer, Republicans can pass what they want. The governor can veto all or part of it. Where do you see the budget going and getting wrapped up?
Oh, gosh. I mean, if we're putting money out there and guessing on it right now, I'm not sure they actually pass the budget. And I think your listeners will probably recognize that if a budget's not passed in Wisconsin, the government doesn't shut down. We just continue with the zombie budget of Scott Walker until something else is passed. So I'm not optimistic that the Republicans are working in earnest to actually get something done. I'd be shocked if they actually do, though.
We'll leave it there for now. Senator Larson, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you so much.
That's Chris Larson, Democratic State Senator from Milwaukee and ranking Democrat on the Senate Committee on Education. He co-authored a bill that would require local governments to lay out on their property tax bills how much money is going to voucher schools. We talked about that and wider issues of education funding here in the state. You can follow the ongoing twists and turns in the budget debate with our news department over at WPR.org/news. Wisconsin fruit is on the map, the travel map. The travel experts at Fodors.com have an article up titled, "These Small Towns Are Totally Obsessed with Fruit." They list 10 places with festivals and traditions connected to local fruit, and Wisconsin has one of those 10 spots. Jacksonport gets the nod for its connection to cherries, in part because of their Cherry Fest coming up in August. And the article talks more generally about the Door County cherry scene. That's great. It makes a lot of sense. Door County cherries, famous the world over. But I say Wisconsin can step up its game and take at least one more spot on the list. Let's look at the competition. Prickly pears were captured by Superior, Arizona. Going to have a hard time topping them for prickly pears here in Wisconsin. Key limes go to Key West. It's in the name. You can't beat that. But strawberries go to Ponchatoula, Louisiana. We can beat that, right? I'm informed by a local source that the Ponchatoula strawberries are indeed sweet, but we've got a lot of good strawberries here. Raspberries go to a place in Washington State. What? I've got raspberry plants growing in my backyard, and I'm a terrible gardener. We can beat that. and nobody is listed right now for apples or cranberries. Easy peasy. Nominate your favorite Wisconsin small-town fruit pairing. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.